And our special guest tonight, L.A. Marzulli, as we talk about his work on the trail of the Nephilim 2. We'll get into the Watchers as well when we come right back. Welcome back, Lynn Marzulli with us. L.A., tell us about the trip to Peru. You found a baby mummy. What was that?
Absolutely astounding, George. The first time we were down there, and again, this is the work of part of it's Brian Forrester, and of course, Senior Juan Navarro is the curator of the museum there. And we just got treated so well, carte blanche, we got to handle all the artifacts. Senior Juan opened up everything. The museum was closed just for us, our film crew, the people that were down there with helping us look at the artifacts. And when we were down there the first time, this is back in 2013, we noticed that there was this elongated, what we would call a baby skull. I mean, it appeared to be a baby skull, and it came from the Changos Necropolis. And of course, the Changos Necropolis, actually, there's a shot of this. It's on the Coast website. You scroll down, it's number 11, the Paracas people, and the mummy bundle is the skull on the right. And it was very small, and it appeared to be elongated. When we were down there the first time, Senior Juan would not let us unwrap it. So in the course of the 8 months between the first and second trip, Senior Juan allowed us to unwrap it for several reasons. One, it began to really smell up the museum, and because of it was still wrapped up in the mummy bundle. And so we had Dr. Aaron Junkins, who was an archaeologist. He came down with us. Joe Taylor from the Mont Blanco Museum. Joe basically sculpted the head, and we had a forensic team headed up by Chase Klosky, UFO investigator, field investigators, amazing woman. And, of course, we filmed everything for Watchers, and we got down there. George, it was unbelievable. I mean, you can't – I kind of pinch myself sometimes to look at some of the stuff that we're doing. And we took the thing out of the case, and Joe Taylor spent most of the day unwrapping the baby mummy. The textiles were absolutely incredible. And this, again, points to something that's anomalous with the Paracas people. Now, remember, the Paracas Museum is on the west coast or on the coast of Peru, about a three-hour drive south and west of Lima, which is the capital. So it's south of Lima, and it's this little town that gets basically no rain, but there's this underground river that comes from the highlands, and so there's these green belts where you can pretty much grow some seed on the ground, the stuff just grows. It's amazing. So the Paracas people settled there about 3,500 years ago, and this corresponds with our hypothesis of Joshua and Caleb going into the Promised Land. Nephilim tribes are there, the diaspora, they begin to flee northward through Europe, out the Mediterranean, out the Red Sea, and into the Pacific, and guess what? The Paracas people show up 3,500 years ago. Here's what's astounding. European textiles 2,000 years ago, or earlier than that, had about 150 to 200 threads per square inch. Sit down, because the Paracas textiles have 450 to 550 per square inch, and they're reversible.
Huh.
Where did the technology come from? It's like we talked about before the break. Where does this where does it come from? How do these people know it? Where did they get it from? And so we're unwrapping the baby skull. And the pictures of this, of course, in the new book are just astounding. And hours later, we get the first look at the skull. And we realize that, wait a minute, this is way too big, way too elongated. We're not sure even what we're looking at. And I remember when Joe just very delicately lifted up the last piece, when we got the first look at the hair color, and we the chatter went through the roof. We were all just taken aback. George, it was strawberry blonde. And that goes against the Darwinian idea, or the anthropological idea or theory, that everything, all these people that settled North, Central, and South America came across at the last ice age from the Bering Strait. It goes against that. This was strawberry blonde hair. We estimate the skull to be about 2,000 years. It was very, very elongated. And what's interesting is, and this Brian Forrester sent me this, and it, again, this shot is up on the Coast website. Thank you, Webmaster Lex. But this shows a elongated skull from 1842. we had been attacked. I had been attacked personally from people who insist that all these skulls are the result of cradle headboarding. Well, guess what? Go back to 1842, and this same battle is raging between academics. Oh, it's all cradle headboarding. That's what's causing it. We have an explanation. There's nothing supernatural here. Please don't look behind the curtain. It's all cradle headboarding. And Brian and myself and my partner Richard Shaw, all of us believe that. Some of the stuff is cradle headboarded. David Childress believes the same thing. Yeah, some of it's cradle headboarded, but some of it's not. Some of it seems to be genetic. And some of the people who are doing the cradle headboarding seem to be emulating something. So Brian sends me this journal from 1842, and I about fell out of my chair. These guys, these primitive archaeologists, and I'll read it to you. This is what they state. We ourselves have observed the same fact. Remember this, 1842. We ourselves have observed the same fact in many mummies of children of tender age who, although they had cloth about them, were yet without any vestige or appearance of pressure of the cranium. More still, the same elongated formation of the head presents itself in children yet unborn. And of this truth, we had convincing proof in the sight of a fetus enclosed in the womb of a mummy of a pregnant woman.
That's dramatic.
It's unbelievable. And remember, in 1842, there's no cameras, but they have field artists that go wherever they go. And there's sketches, a frontal view and a side view. And here's what's chilling. This little fetus has teeth, and that shouldn't be. It's an elongated skull, and it has teeth. So
sounds like a monster.
Well, it's not conclusive. Okay, we definitely need the DNA evidence. But here we have the skull from 1842, and here we have the little baby skull that we unwrapped in Senior Juan's museum, and the two are extremely similar. And this points again to the fact that there seems to be an outside agency that is playing with the genome, that's messing with the genome, and it points right back to the Nephilim, which bolsters that biblical narrative. And that's what I find so absolutely fascinating with this.
Are these human, or are these extraterrestrial?
Well, I wouldn't say extraterrestrial. I would say they are part interdimensional. And we're like a half an inch away from each other. All you got to do is change that word from extraterrestrial to interdimensional. We're all on the same page. We agree that something is going on. An outside agency is manipulating the genome. If Giorgio Tsoukalos was here, Giorgio would say it's extraterrestrial. I'm saying interdimensional. Yeah. We're a half an inch away from each other. We both know something's going on, and we're excited about it.
Claws and teeth with babies.
Crazy.
That is weird. It really is. What did you find? And now you went to Camacho also, didn't you?
Yes.
What happened there?
Very disturbing site. Camacho is, again, very close to Paracas. It's about a half an hour away. It's very difficult to get there. The road is dirt. It doesn't get washed out because it doesn't rain, but it's got a lot of ruts in it, and it's very difficult to get there. At one point, our van almost capsized, literally. We almost went off the road, and Brian Forrester reached up and grabbed the wheel and yanked it. I mean, that's how crazy some of these places are, and it's a very, very bizarre place. It's like it's the remains of an old ocean, George, and there are patches. This entire mountainside was encrusted with this salt, which had formed these. It's hard to describe. It's almost like frozen waves, just frozen waves. And as you walk up the side of this hill for at least a half a mile, there's all this crunching beneath your feet, and it's desolate as far as you can see going up the mountain. It's just desolate. Nothing grows because of all the salt. It's a barren wasteland. Behind us was where one of these underground rivers are. It's a huge green belt. But up on this mountain, up on this small mountain, it's nothing grows. It's just completely denuded. It looks like a lunar landscape, or you're on another planet. That's how bizarre it was. Never been to any place like it before. And we finally reached the summit, and in the distance, I got my first look at Camacho. And unfortunately, I don't think we have a shot of that on your website. But we're there at Camacho, and even from, I don't know, 50 feet, 100 feet away, we can see that what's going on, and this is really weird. And when Richard Shaw and I and the team got up there, Richard and I looked at each other and we said, oh my gosh, it's like Auschwitz. It's like, this is not a good thing. These people, it looked like a killing zone. That's the first time I saw it. I went back two other times and we really studied it. And we started to, remember this, Camacho is a site that has been hit by the Huacaros or the grave robbers. And so they go in there looking for gold, silver, mummy wrappings, cloaks, tapestries, all that stuff. By the way, elongated skulls go on the black market for $1,000 a piece or more.
That much?
Yeah, that much and more. And what we found in this grave were at least the remains of 50 skeletons. We just counted skulls, okay? At least 50. All of them, many of them that we picked up, showed signs of being hit on the head, the side of the head with a blunt instrument. They were either, the skull was cracked, there was a hole, and all of them had that hit. There's no funerary objects buried here. This is a killing zone. It's a kill zone.
Sacrifice area?
We don't know. I'm theorizing this, George. All the skulls there were elongated. All of the skulls at Camacho were elongated, showed signs of either cradle headboarding or without that sagittal suture that goes back from the frontal plate that bisects the two or creates the two parietal plates. Many of them didn't have that. It really needs to be investigated. What we think, this is what I'm theorizing, another race of people moved into the area. And for whatever reason, they rounded up these people and killed them all.
Killed them all, yeah. And these people, this other race could not defend itself?
Well, this goes back into the Native American legend, the oral traditions of our tribe went against the red-headed giants who were cannibals and killed them all. The Paiutes have a legend where they rounded them up in a cave, the Lovelock Cave. And all these giants, the small tribe of giants, I guess, fled into this cave, and the Paiutes, for days, piled all this brush and packed it, and they said, will you stop eating our people? And these giants said no, and they lit the cave on fire, and the rest is history. I've been to that cave in Lovelock, and it's absolutely fascinating. But that oral tradition, this is what got me thinking, because we hear this over and over and over again in Native American oral tradition, that Native American tribes went up against a race of cannibalistic people that were red-haired, six fingers in many cases, sometimes double rows of teeth, and that were giants. Well, when we apply that to what's in South America, and this is conjecture on my part, I totally admit that, is there a similarity? Were these elongated skull people killed for sort of the same reasons? We don't know. This is why it's so important to do more research down there, and of course we're trying to mount another expedition sometime in 2015.
I'm still baffled, L.A., how they've just disappeared. I can't believe they've all been obliterated.
It sure seems like it, and I don't, you know, I don't have all the answers. What's interesting is that in the turn of the century, the last century, the 19th century, into the 20th century, all through the Americas, people started doing these primitive archaeological digs and finding the remains of giants. We get this in the historical record. We get newspaper reports. When I was out in Catalina, we can talk about that if you want to, but when I was out in Catalina, what I found there was absolutely astounding. With NAGPRA, Native American Grave Protection Repatriation Act, we no longer can go in, and if there's a human remain anywhere found, the archaeologist is called in, the coroner is called in, everything comes to a grinding halt.
Yeah.
And because of NAGPRA, and I get it. In most cases, it's somebody's uncle. I get that. And we need to have the utmost respect for Native American remains. I understand that. We should not be displaying them in museums. I am down and jiggy with that.
There's a however coming.
There is a however. And that however is this. Where we have remains, these giant skeletons, we should be able to go in, or anomalous skeletons like we find in Peru.
Yeah.
And this is why we went there, because this is one of the few places where we can go. George, when I was at the Chongos Necropolis, and I've been there four times. It is unbelievable. The last time I was there, we found, Brian and I found, we found three elongated skulls that had just been unearthed. For some reason, the grave robbers, the Huacaros, got spooked and left them there. I have no idea what happened. We were walking out, and there was a set of tire tracks, and I'm looking, it's about 100 yards away. I'm going, gee, it looks like a skull. And we get closer and go, well, maybe it's just a Clorox bottle. And we got about 50 yards away, and it's like, oh, my gosh, it's a skull.
Just right out there.
Right out there. And Brian sees it, and he looks at the tire tracks. This is how astute he is. He abandons us, and he runs in the direction of the tire tracks. He finds the open grave where there are skeletal remains and two elongated skulls. We found three. We were with an archaeologist, a Peruvian archaeologist, and they are now all listed in Senior One's Paracas History Museum in Paracas, Peru. So, I mean, find it itself. I mean, it's just, you can't make this stuff up. And it's a type of find that most archaeologists would just dream about. And here we are, and it's commonplace in the Chongos necropolis.
What is it about this area, this region?
Well, again, this is a very arid area. It only gets about a quarter of an inch of rain per year, if that.
Sounds like Los Angeles.
Yeah, let's not go there. We really need rain. At least
it's
drizzling here tonight, so that's good news. But it only gets the Chongos Necropolis was the most barren place I have ever been in my life. It reminded me of the Sahara. There's actually dunes there, and we were climbing around the dunes and found evidence of tombs which had not yet been opened. Since the Columbus, the discovery, 1492 and on, that area has been plundered by Huacaros and grave robbers for the last basically 500 years. And we see evidence of that wherever you walk. The first time I was there, we've talked about this before, George, but a lot of new listeners. The first time I was there, Brian didn't say a word about it. He just took us there and let us discover it on our own. And we all kind of fanned out, and I'm walking through this absolute dry, sandy area. I look down, and the first thing I notice is that there's all these red and white things. What the heck is this? And I bend over and I pick up a pottery shard. And I go, you've got to be kidding me. And then I look a little further and there's this white object and it's a bone. And I'm saying, oh my gosh. And the further we got in, now all of a sudden there's skull caps and ribs and femurs and tibias and pottery and parts of pottery and wari slingshots that are 1,000 years old. And you just sit there, the mind reels because it's an archaeological treasure trove and no one cares. No one cares. And that's why we go there, we get the artifacts, we bring them right back to Senior Juan's Museum. It's just astounding.
I want to talk with you when we come back about the Nazca Lines. Of course, that's what made Eric von Däniken what he is now, Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
Would you give out your website, by the way? And how can people get on the trail of the Nephilim, too?
www.lamarzulli.net. And we've got to talk about Catalina because those pictures are right up on your site, George.
Yeah. That is true. That is an amazing place. Have you heard, by the way, about this structure off the coast of Malibu?
We are thinking about investigating it, quite frankly. And if you want to, we'd love to have you come along. We're actually toying with that idea. Maybe in January, renting.
I'll be here. Yeah,
equipment.
We should do that.
Absolutely.
We should. If people need to email you if they have information for you. How do they get to you?
LA@LAMarzulli.net. LA@LAMarzulli.net.
MarZulli.
That's it.
All right, Lynn, stay with us. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And as I invite you all to just like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, because we're always posting some current event and some great information for you. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with L.A. Marzulli. But when we come back, let's talk about what he discovered at Catalina Island off the coast of California, of course. And then also we'll talk about the Nazca Lines, those strange things that you can only make out from above. Well, we've got a great thing for you. Producer Tom Danheiser came up with an idea and said, look, I want us to create a CD and give proceeds to veterans charities. I'll put it together. I'll do it all. I'll be responsible for it. I just need you folks to donate your time and your voice to with this CD. So he rounded up a lot of coast-to-coast guests, Whitley Strieber, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, the great Pat Boone, and I even sang a song for Tom. And he put it together in a Holiday Magic Coast-style CD Full information at our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. What a wonderful gift for the person you care about, and it's right out there for you. Catalina Island, of course, is a rocky island off the coast of California. It is 22 miles long and 8 miles wide. And Lynn, tell me about this little escapade. What happened?
That is incredible. I actually heard this from Jim Watson, who wrote a book called Mysterious Catalina. And in it, he talks about this primitive archaeologist that was employed in the early part of the 20th century, 1919, and from there on out, by the name of Ralph Glidden, who apparently lived on the island. He was employed by the High Museum, and he conducted these primitive archaeological digs and finds all through the Channel Islands. And apparently, there were hints of nine-footers being found on the island. So one thing led to another, and I actually went down to the museum at UCLA and spoke to the head archaeologist there and got to view the remains. They were all Native Americans. You walk into this room that the public doesn't go to, and everything was just even a cursory glance, all Native Americans, nothing anomalous at all. So I was kind of bummed by that. But at dinner, Jim Watson was telling me that they had just discovered, or fairly recently discovered, this cache of records, photographs, journals. And some of these photographs are actually on the Coast website now that came from the Glidden collection. And I'll only get to the end before I pick up the story. Sure. I interviewed John Borgina, the former curator of the museum. He was a curator when I had finally got access to it, but later on they let him go for whatever reason. But John came on the record with me. He's a brilliant man. And he said that some of the photographs went missing. And what happened was, they knew that Ralph Glidden had a museum, conducted these digs, had a cache of records, photographs, journals, everything else that went missing. And John was the curator of the museum, and this is in that large circular building that Wrigley built at Avalon on Catalina Island. And he's showing movies, and the museum, the Catalina Museum, is in the basement. So above that, and then we've got the attic. So he's rummaging around in the attic, and God knows what's up there, all this stuff. And it's right out of a Hollywood movie script. He comes on this trunk, opens the trunk, and he's just astounded there. He realizes what he's looking at. This is the lost Ralph Glidden files. And it took me months of negotiating, but I finally had access. I donated a little donation to the museum. I'm more happy to do that. Was able to go in the back room, met John Borgina. They had two tables with white paper on them. They had stacks of the museum boxes. Everything had already been cataloged, looked at, and filed. First thing I did is I got the files with the pictures, George. Within the first 45 minutes, I found pay dirt. And three or four of those pictures, actually the whole sequence, is on the Coast website. And that first picture, number three, is a six-fingered skeleton.
And those were pretty common in those days.
Well, they were and they weren't. We hear reports of this in all the newspapers from like Pennsylvania, Ohio, down into St. Louis, Missouri, you know, and out west. We hear about the six fingers. As far as I know, I've never seen a picture of one. And when I saw this, I was completely taken aback by it. This is polydactylism. We get that. If you look at number three, you'll see that little bowl there. That bowl, the curator, John Borgina, believes it's 6 inches. Based on the bowl, right next to the skeleton, and we had a computer analysis do this with these pictures, we're looking, George, at a 9-footer. He estimates that skeleton to be 9 feet, and it's got 6 fingers, and it, wow, it corresponds and takes us back to the what we hear in the Native American oral tradition of red-haired, six-fingered giants. And the question is, what happened to the skeleton? Nobody knows. In number four, when I saw this photograph, I was just taken aback. Unfortunately, there's really no measuring device at all. The Glidden didn't use them, which drives me nuts and drives everybody else nuts. There's no way to tell what you're really looking at. But these, and you'll see elongated skull found on Catalina. The small child that was exhumed has a very long, elongated skull. And this reminded us of a skeleton that we saw in Peru, thousands of miles away in Huatara, almost exactly alike, just based on the photograph. And when we look at the the skeleton above that, we see that the skull goes way back. It's very, very elongated. Pay dirt for me, and this is why I was on, the Vieira brothers had me on the show, because I had this photograph. I found this photograph. I discovered it in the archives. When I showed it to John Borogina, he was taken aback, as he was by the other photographs. They had, whoever looked at the treasure trove of records, weren't impressed by these things. I was completely taken aback. And what we have here is number five on the Coast site. We see Ralph Glidden, circa 1919, standing in an open pit, recently excavated grave. We can see the tools of his trade, a pickaxe, a couple of shovels, a screen. There is a small human head, which is next to him on the left-hand side. But in front of him is a very large skeleton. And this is what I did. And I hats off to my friend and colleague, the Prophecy of the News, who's been on your show before. And Gary said, you know, L.A., there's people that can look at a photograph like this, and we know the height of Ralph Glidden at 5'8". They can digitize all this and put it in a computer, digitize it, and they can tell you what how big the skeleton is. So I went on my blog, and I basically put wanted computer analysis who can tell from pictures the heights of individuals or objects. George, I got four people that responded. I now have a quadruple blind study going on. They don't know about each other. I didn't tell them, so all the results were in. A quadruple blind study. I send the same photograph to each person, tell them, and John Borogina verified this. Glidden was, it was verified by numerous witnesses.
Hey, Lynn, let me stop you. I need you to switch phones again. Can you do that?
It's just so bizarre.
They are crackling like fire.
George, I have they're fully charged. I'm right next to the base. I have no idea. Let me do it right now. Hold
okay,
on.
Yeah, we'll do that. Live radio. We're making this
live
switch.
Radio. How is that?
All right, let's hope so. Let's hope.
God.
I mean, you started off fine, and then it just went into this. You know,
there may be other forces at work, George.
Before, it's happened so. Before. That's absolutely true. So back to this. I mean, that's amazing. How come we haven't heard that before about that?
No one has done anything with the photograph. I mean, this photograph laid in a an archive, or, you know, hidden in a chest for who knows how many decades, at least 50 years. And what's interesting, Borogina went on the record, and I said this earlier, some of the photographs went missing, but not this one. And one of the computer analysis and the ones that you have on the site, on the Coast site, this is done by Michael Register. He took the photograph of Ralph Glidden and straightened it up. And then he took the skeleton in the foreground and straightened it up. And he accounted for the difference between, you know, distances. And basically what we're looking at, and this is what's incredible about this, and he's rounded it off. He estimated it at 8'9", but he rounded it down to 8'6", and that's what we went with in the book, 8'6". And this is astounding. We have real photographic proof of a giant that's 8'6" tall, one with six fingers and elongated skull. And this points back to our earlier discussion that there's something, some outside agency messing with the genome. Something's going on here, and it points back to the Nephilim, in my opinion.
Well, if they're messing around, then you're saying it's the Nephilim that might be doing it?
I think it's these interdimensional beings that we would call fallen angels.
What do they want?
Well, this is what's interesting. And let's go to Graham Hancock's book, The Supernatural, you know, coast to coast regular. And Graham states in his book, The Supernatural, he's doing ayahuasca, powerful hallucinogenic. In my opinion, he's being bounced up to what I would call the second heaven. Guess who's there? And he's astonished at what he sees. He sees the Greys. What the heck are the Greys doing there? And he realizes at the end of the book, his summation is basically this. It seems like these entities are very interested in reproducing with us. They want to reproduce with us. And this goes right back to the Genesis 6 account where we read the sons of God, which are the fallen angels, by the way, came to earth, saw the women of earth, sex with them, the Nephilim. And this is the resulting of the flood. And it goes back to Genesis 3. Your seed will be at enmity with the seed of the woman. The fallen angelic seed will be at enmity with the seed of the woman. And on it goes. We are in a genetic war. That's what's going on here.
If there are fallen angels, what about the devil, Lucifer? Where is he in the picture? Does he come up at all?
Well, he's the head of the whole deal. Let me get a slurp of water here.
Sure.
He's the head of the whole deal. I mean, he led the rebellion. And look, you know, some people read this stuff, just kind of roll their eyeballs. We are looking at a highly intelligent, super genius, intelligent, but highly malevolent entity who comes to rob, kill, and destroy. That's his mission. And wherever he goes, that's what he does. And we fingerprints everywhere, just like 6 o'clock, in my opinion. And so I would suggest that this figure, and we've talked about this on your show many times, the idea of the Antichrist. I believe that the Antichrist will actually be a modern Nephilim and will be the seed of the serpent himself, will be Satan's offspring, literally. That's what I think it will be. And I think he's alive on the planet.
Now, the Nazca lines, of course, that's what Eric von Däniken hung his hat on. What did you find there?
Well, in Nazca, very, very interesting. And the Nazca lines, there are a lot of theories about them. No one theory explains it all. Maria Reich, who was down there for decades, dedicated her life in the preservation of the lines, believed that they were somehow tied to astronomical events and solar alignment, that sort of thing. Other people recently believe that some of the lines may have to do with the underground water, because water is precious there. Without water, you can't grow anything, and when you can't grow anything, you can't live there, specifically in antiquity. Some of the lines, George, and this is where it's really interesting, and Brian pointed this out to me, tower that Maria Reich erected with her own money right along the main American. And the tower is about 50 feet up, and you can only have 10 people on the tower at a time, and you pay a couple of bucks and up you go. And of course, we went up the tower. What's interesting, George, which is absolutely fascinating, is from the top of the tower, which is about 50 feet up, you can see two of the glyphs. Now, they're smaller glyphs, but you can see them very, you know, one is called the tree of life, the other one is called the bird, and you can see them. And so we were talking about this, you know, people aren't stupid. Maybe the lines were done, some of the lines, not all, but some of the lines were done in this fashion, where you could create a tower like this and someone would oversee them. But then it gets really weird, George, because we get lines that are perfectly straight and go for miles. And it's like, it begs the question, who the heck gets up on a Monday morning and you know, goes, okay, let's go to Nazca where there's no rain, it's really hot, and we're just going to make this straight line without string, because we don't have string that goes a mile forever. But if we do, this is what we're going to do. Why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? And so it's really incredibly enigmatic. But what we found, what interested me, more than anything, and we actually show some of this, again, on the Coast website, we found elongated skulls, and many of them were actually trophy skulls. And what I mean by that, the Nazca people, which came way after the Paracas people, and Senior Juan believes that the Paracas people originated the lines in Nazca, that these, again, we see these elongated skulls are being used for trophy heads. And what these Nazca people would do, they would put a hole in the head and wrap leather around it and wear these skulls on their belts as trophies, which is incredibly macabre and obviously really bizarre. One of the most bizarre finds there was this dreadlock skull, and the dreadlocks were at least 5 feet long that were still attached to the skull. And that was in real life. In life, that person must have been very, very bizarre to look at.
And these were elongated skulls?
Yes, elongated skulls.
And not all of them could have been pulled, right?
Well, we don't know. We just don't know. You know,
what would Lloyd be doing these days if he were still alive, Lloyd Pye?
Lloyd Pye would be probably running down to Paracas trying to get more samples out. I was on his site today, coincidentally, and looked at, you know, they're trying to raise $250,000 to do the genome, complete genome of the Starchild skull. This is important, and it begs the question, George, why aren't anthropologists beating his door down? You know,
or some university or some grant? I know.
Why?
That's a good question. Why does the Smithsonian hide some of these things?
And look, we all know that we have record after record after record where the Smithsonian requests the remains are carted up, and they're gone. They're completely gone forever. No one ever sees them. Some of the artifacts, and I talk about this in the book, of course, but some of the artifacts you'll see in a museum, large spearhead. Abnormally large, and underneath it will say, "This is a ceremony of Hopewell Indians." Well, we're not given, the public is not given the context in which that spearhead was found. In other words, we don't know where the spearhead came from. Did it come from a site where a 9-footer was? Because if we have a 9-footer, all of a sudden that spearhead, that very large spearhead, isn't ceremonial. It becomes utilitarian. It becomes a weapon in the hands of a 9-footer. We found one object like this, which we call the Nephilim Lance. There's a picture of it on the Coast website, number two, and it shows everyone, Bob Shelley and myself, holding this large bronze pounded artifact, which was found by the man in the middle, Bob Shelley, in the wilderness of Michigan. We've had it analyzed in a metallurgical lab, and it's 99, it's almost pure copper, and there's a little tin in it. And we know that the copper in that area is pure. It's some of the purest copper in the world. And we can see that the edge, whoever did this, pounded. We know that Native Americans didn't work metal like this. This is bronze. It's a bronze artifact. And when we first saw it, we thought it was a sword. But Chief Joseph, who's in the picture, he's a Taino war chief, and he knows about the oral traditions. He looked at us and said, "Guys, you're looking at it through your cultural eyes. It's not a sword. It's a lance." And George, that lance weighs 7.5 pounds. There's an article. There's a scriptural text which talks about the spirit of this giant that weighed 300 shekels. You convert shekels to pounds, 0.5 pounds, blown away. The oral tradition of Native Americans talk about this Nephilim lance, we call it a Nephilim lance, that these giants would come in with these long lances and they would spear three of the braves. And that's why we're all standing like this, because this lance goes through us very, very easily. We find that just, and we're actually trying to find a weapons expert who can tell us what we're looking at.
Almost like butter, Lynn. So we're going to come back, a final hour to go. We're going to take phone calls about the Nephilim, about the Watchers, and about the things you've heard us talking about here on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, don't forget our programs tomorrow and a little holiday schedule for you. Thanksgiving, which comes up in a few weeks now. We'll have a live show for you on Thanksgiving night. And, of course, during the holiday season, we, too, will be here on Christmas Eve, Christmas night, New Year's Eve, and New Year's night as we kick in 2015. Truly unbelievable. Okay, get ready to make the calls. We'll use the interactive portion of the show now with Lynn Marzulli and you on Coast to Coast AM.